So welcome everyone, and I'm Bunkai Sujato, and we're here to do some meditation, some chanting, some Dhamma talk, and if we're lucky, we might even, and I don't want to oversell it here, but we might even find a bit of peace and a bit of wisdom. But I'm not making any promises, okay? So you're not getting your money back, I don't care. Okay, fine. And I'm here in the land of the Baramadigal people of the Darug Nation. And we pay respects to the elders, past, present, and emerging. And welcome. So just a minute to settle down, and then we'll do some chanting. So, by the way, we don't have chanting sheets here, do we? Should we?
No, they can get it on their phone.
That's hardcore. I like it. It's nice. Okay. Is that good? So we have chanting over at Crow's Nest. I made chanting sheets, but if you want it, then there's no. So if you don't know the chanting, you can find it on your phone, or just easy, just learn it. Not too hard. All right. That's good.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Iti piso bhagavā arahaṃ sammāsambuddho vijjācaraṇa sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhammasārathi Sattha deva manusanam buddho bhagavati. Svakato bhagavata dhammo sandirthiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko Pachatam veditabo vinyuhiti. Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Ujjupatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. Nyaya patipanno bhagavato sava sangho. Yami chipatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho yadidam chata haripurisa yungani arthapurisa pungala esa bhagavato savaka sangho Ahuneyo, Pahuneyo, Dakhineyo, Anjali Karaniyo, Anutarang Punyaketa Lokasati.
Okay, very good. All right. So we're all settled down? Ready to do some meditation? Yes? Good, excellent. What kind of meditation would you like to do? So I'm going to give you three options, all right? We're going to vote on meditation today in celebration of the fact that we still live in a democracy. Yay! Number one, mindfulness of breathing. Yeah. Number two, metta, loving kindness meditation. Number three, okay, so number three is a special option for today. Number three is I'm going to let go my choice and let Bhante decide what meditation we do. Okay? So which one is it? Number one, breath meditation. We have one, two. Anyone else? Breath meditation. Okay, two. Loving kindness meditation. You can vote online as well. Loving kindness meditation. One, two. Okay. I'm going to let go and let Bhante decide. Number three. Which, how many people? Most people here say number three. Online. What do we have? Three, 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 two. From Melanie. Excellent, Melanie. Three and three. Okay, so fun fact, that was a trick. Okay, that's not what letting go means in Buddhism, okay? Why? Because Buddhism isn't a cult. And letting go doesn't just mean doing whatever the guru tells you you should do, okay? So all of those who voted for three, you need to go away and think about what you've done, okay? The correct answer was, whichever meditation will help me be free, will help me overcome greed, hate, and delusion. This one is the one that we should do. Yeah? So, as for that, which meditation is going to help you overcome greed, hate, and delusion? I don't know, actually, unfortunately. And this is one of the problems with that. Like, I could sit here and tell you to do these meditations, as you know, but reality is, greed, hate, and delusion arise inside you. Yes, inside every one of us. And so ultimately, we have to be the ones to know what we're going to do. So when we are learning and we're learning our practice, we don't really know, actually. Certain meditations, sometimes they seem like they work, other times other meditations seem like they work, and we're really just sort of fumbling around. G'day. Welcome. And so we just have to try things. So for today, why don't we do, even though it was the unpopular choice, why don't we do some mindfulness of breathing? What do you reckon? I think people usually don't vote for it because they're like, oh, it's a bit boring, I want to do something different. But fun fact, it's not boring if you do it right. Yay. So we'll do some mindfulness of breathing, and we will investigate at the end. This is why we reflect at the end of the meditation, and we ask ourselves, did this actually do what it's supposed to do? Did this actually help us to become more peaceful? Did it help our mind to become more free? That's how we learn, right? So there's no like set answer to which is the right meditation, but we learn through experience and through reflection. So I'll say a few words about our breath meditation before we go on. Now, we have people here in Harris Park in Sydney enjoying a nice warm day, a nice warm kind of a bit too warm for the time of year, but anyway, a nice warm day, and we have people joining us from all over the world, I can see, from France, from Austria, and oh, someone else from France, that's good, and various people from around the place, including other parts of Sydney, so that's good. But one thing that we all have in common is that we all breathe. That's right, isn't it? Unless we're on like a respirator or something like that, we're all breathing. Okay, so this breathing meditation is something that unites us all. It's something that it doesn't depend on a particular ideology. It doesn't depend on like even what religion you belong to or what your beliefs are or anything like that. Everybody breathes. And because of that, everybody can bring attention to their breathing and find peace within that. So this is the good news. Breath gives us life. It brings energy and vitality and spirit to every cell in our body, every minute of every day. And through the breathing, we are sustained, our body is sustained, and our mind is sustained. Yeah? And so as we are breathing, our breath is a kind of movement, a kind of energy that is nourishing and caring for and settling and balancing all of our energies of mind and body. That's why meditation on the breath is such a powerful meditation. When we pay attention to the breath in meditation, what we realize is that the breath itself has this power to bring calm and to bring peace into our heart. And so the meditation isn't about us, it's not about what we do, and it's not about, like, one of the things that I really dislike when people talk about meditation, people say things like, oh, I'm going to use the breath as a tool, right? These kinds of things, right? The breath is not a spanner, okay? The path to Nibbana is not a toolkit, okay? Yes, of course, breath has a function, right? It does have a utility. But let's not think about our spiritual path in such reductive and mechanistic terms. What we are doing is expanding our consciousness. We're freeing our mind. We're growing spiritually. We're becoming better human beings. And the breath brings us along that path. There's an avenue for us along that path. So when we pay attention to the breathing, the breathing will look after us and care for us, not just physically, but also emotionally and spiritually as well. And it has that dimension already, like it's already doing that, even before we started to meditate. But when we meditate, that aspect of the breath, that dimension of the breath, becomes prominent. And as we go deeper into meditation, the breath, the physical experience of the breath, transforms itself, and we see within that breath a pleasure, a sense of happiness and joy, a sense of uplifting. And the more we go deeper into that, we see the breath also contains within itself a kind of light. The breath becomes radiant. And we realize that these are not something which is new or separate or different. These are dimensions of the breath that our mind is not usually subtle enough to perceive. And so through meditation, when we see these things, these are signs that our mind has become more subtle. And we're seeing the same breath, same reality as we saw before, but we're just seeing. Oh, by the way, when we're using this network, we're using this Wi-Fi network, Everybody should be have an expression of gratitude to our friends down in Syro, who invented Wi-Fi. If you didn't know, I don't know if Kami's around. Then anyway, convey our gratitude to CSIRO for inventing Wi-Fi, and then also for not knowing what to do with it. So yeah, anyway. They also invented self-driving vehicles in the 80s and didn't think there'd be much application for it, so they just kind of let it go. Anyway, moving along. All right, so yes, the deeper we go into the meditation, the breath it's very fascinating, right? Because the breath, it turns into something which is like a river of light that we can like flow down. And I know I'm using this very kind of almost like purple kind of imagery to describe this thing, but that's how it appears in your meditation. And the kind of the mundane sort of organic breath, you sort of see beyond that and you realize that you're actually just seeing like the surface dimension of the world. Underneath, there's so many different layers and so many different dimensions. And of course, that's not just the breath that's like that, but that's how we see through the breath. And so so as we see this is a sign that that the hindrances that are clouding our mind are starting to fall away, right? This is what the word hindrance means. So a hindrance in Buddhism, these are the things that stop our meditation from progressing, and the hindrances act as a covering or a cloud that obscure knowledge, obscure knowing. And as we meditate more deeply, they fall away and our mind manifests as it has always had the potential to do. All right. So let us do some meditation. Okay. So let's sit quietly. Set our backs straight. If you want to sit on the floor, then that's good. If you want to sit on a chair, that's also fine. But make sure that your back is fairly straight, that your body is collected and dignified, not too sloppy and relaxed, but also not too tense and uptight. Now, just taking a minute to check in with how you're feeling, how your emotions and moods are right now.
so that you feel an understanding of where you are at. Doesn't matter what your mood is, it's okay, as long as you know it. Don't be judging or trying to change it. It's okay. Just be aware of it. And now bring awareness very gently to the feeling of the breath as it comes in and breath as it goes out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, gently, soothingly, easing your mind and your body. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. sometimes the mind will forget and it'll be seized by some thoughts, by some random movements or memories, or invent all of these fantastic worlds to play in. Worlds of imagination and desire, worlds of dreams, images. And all of those worlds are so thin and so light. They just come up and then they just pop away and disappear. Like a bubble. And we get so caught up in them, and yet they mean so little. So we let the breathing come, and we let the breathing take care of us. It soothes us, it calms us. We let it take us to a place of peace. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. And as you continue You feel inside the breath that there's a softness, a pleasure, a deep sense of contentment. Your breath just brings to you, feels so lovely, so warm. You feel like you just want to stay there. Why would you send your mind out anywhere else? Just want to be there, just want to be still, just want to keep the mind settled. And now we're coming to the end of the meditation, bringing the mind back into the body, into the sounds, and experiencing all of the things that's going on around us right now. Before we come out of meditation, take a minute to cast the mind back, inquiring into cause and effect. Ask yourself, what's just happened? How did I use my mind? How did my mind change over that period? How did the breath manifest to me? Was it clear? Was it muddy? Was it bright? And how does your mind compare to how it was at the start of the meditation? So each time we meditate, we should reflect like this, just for a few minutes. That's how we learn how the meditation works. And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Very good. Okay, everybody, let's have a bit of a break, 5 minutes, stretch your legs, and come back for the Dhamma talk. Okay, Dhamma talk. Yes, any suggestions? Dhamma talk? Requests? Anything you want to know about?
You mentioned greed and envy before.
Okay. Sorry, my computer is playing up. Sorry, everyone, I'm not sure if you can hear me on there, but my computer's playing up. I'm going to have to reboot it. Just give me 1 second. Sorry for folks online, but my computer's been misbehaving. I'm not quite sure what's going on. But are we on? Can we hear? Are we good? Let's hope that that goes away, okay? Shame. Moo said she wants to talk about shame. Oh, interesting. Sumana, the difference between Sukha Vedana from Kusala and Sukha Vedana from the work of Mara. Oh my goodness. Dear, oh dear. Sounds a bit much, doesn't it? Anyone else?
What do you think of that notion of, like always looking at the bright side of life?
Oh, so we're going on, just for those online, we're going on a little bit of a Monty Python tangent here. So we're now on the bright side of life. It's a very Buddhist song.
I know. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. It actually quotes from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta in there. It says, things just fall apart in every way. Vayadhamma Sankhara. Yeah, so it's very much... very much a Buddhist thing. okay, so looking on the bright side of life, yeah? Okay, that's an interesting one. Okay, so a few good suggestions there. All right. Okay, just waiting to see if any more come through. All right, so let me start... let me start with that question about being on the bright side of things. So, where to begin? Where to begin? All right, so we know what that means, don't we? Should always look on the bright side? But is that right? Should we? Sometimes... Is that like a Buddhist teaching that we should look on the bright side of things? No? What does the Buddha say we should do? It says everything falls apart. Okay. But does the Buddha say we should look on the bright side of things?
I mean, some people say the Buddha doesn't, right? I mean, for a lot of people, the Buddha's a real kind of Debbie Downer, and he's just like always moaning on about suffering and going about how everything's bad, right? That's how some people think. And so not to gloss it over, says Mel, yeah, which is a good point, yeah? So... we good? Do you want to leave it open? It's a bit hot tonight. It's a bit noisy. It's up to you. Yeah. Pop psychology, especially, to look on the bright side of things. And the fact that it became a thing in pop psychology has its own history, and its own history within psychology and within the development of Western culture. I mean, very briefly, I mean, you have this whole kind of Freudian thing, and Freud was very much going to look at those traumas that have sort of created why we're suffering, you know, and so it's about kind of looking at all of the bad things that have happened, and, you know, try to sort of, you know, let go of the whatever the blockages that those things are creating. And okay, that's fine, but also that can be kind of a bit, it's a bit kind of hard, it's a bit kind of negative, you know. Like I had a friend of mine who was applying for refugee status here in Australia, and, you know, one of the things that he told me that was like really kind of moved me, he said, like, you know, he was talking about how he can get, you know, like his support for the things that he needed. And, you know, I said, oh, well, you know, maybe try that such and such a department or something like that. And he says, you know, he says, I've been to so many of those places, and it's just every time they just sit me down and they make me tell them all the terrible things that's happened to me. And it just makes me really reluctant to go to actually seek any kind of assistance, because I don't want to sit. I've told that story so many times. I don't want to just sit through just retelling. Or, you know, I'm here to make a new life and not to just keep on going over those bad things that have happened to me. And there's something, of course, very truthful and very insightful about that. Another story on similar lines that I heard once when there was, I think it was after the Rwanda massacres, and the UN sent in a bunch of therapists, Western therapists and so on, to try to help people. And the Rwandan women would be like, you know, so in an interview with her, and she's like, we didn't understand what they were doing, you know. She said, you know, when something bad happens to us, we put on our best clothes and we put on some music and we go and dance and we make ourselves happy. But all of these white people wanted to make us sit in these dingy rooms and talk about all the bad things that happened to us. And I was like, what are you, why would you do that? And, you know, there's, right? There's a justifiable reason for it. So, of course, sometimes, you know, it's good to go and you need to look at those things and not be in denial of them. It's true. But there's a difference between saying that it's a, you know, it's healthy to do that from time to time for some people, and then saying, well, that's what we're all going to do. So then there's a counter movement, which is the idea of kind of looking at the bright side of things. And so then that comes up, and then that was very popular, like through in California and through kind of pop psychology, new ageism, and all of these kinds of things. And okay, everything has to be very nice, and everybody has to be very pretty, and all of the places have to look very nice and sweet, and you're not allowed to like have any kind of nasty or bad things. And that became very influential through school curricula, again, as a kind of reaction, you know, because you have a kind of history. If you're a child of the early, late 70s, early 80s like me, then your anthem was, we don't need no education, we don't need no thought control, no dark sarcasm in the classroom. And this is kind of idea of this kind of very kind of sarcastic and so quite cruel way of teaching kids, which obviously was a kind of reality. I mean, for me, it wasn't a reality. My teachers were all pretty good. But there's that kind of thing. And so there's a flip side of saying, well, we can't be criticizing kids too much. You know, we need to be giving them positive feedback. So this idea that you need to lift kids up by giving them encouragement, and then you give them like participation trophies, and then you're always sort of rewarding them, oh, good job, and these kinds of things. But of course, then that also has its problem, because sometimes it really isn't a good job. And it's nice to give people encouragement, but sometimes they really do bad work, and then you've got to have something to say with that. Now, this, how we relate to that then also depends on the kind of personality that you have, right? So some people, if people are suffering maybe from some more anxiety and so on, then probably it is actually really helpful to just give them positive feedback, because otherwise they can be really devastated if they get even a small amount of negative feedback. I had an experience like this not long ago. One of our volunteers, they did some work for us for sort of Central. Very nice of them to offer. They did some work. I said, great. And what I said was, could we make a change to this? It's just a very small change to something. And they're like, oh, I can't do this. I'm like, what's the problem? She said, I can't take that kind of feedback. I mean, I just asked it like this, just a normal process. But obviously, you know, that's an emotional, you know, issue that they're going through, and that makes it really difficult for them to be in a job or something like that. So somebody like that, then they need that special care and attention to help them to sort of get beyond that. For other people, then they're not like that. And, you know, myself, I'm not like that. I like to have good feedback that's like nice and specific and is helpful. If somebody just tells me that what I'm doing is good all the time, I get very suspicious. Sure, it's not that good. I mean, I know it's okay, but... And, you know, I like kind of feedback that's going to be nice and specific and say, well, instead of doing this, you might do that, and so on and so forth. And so for me, that's what I like. And so, of course, that's what I tend to do for others as well. So, if I'm sharing work and working with others, I'll say, well, we'll do this or do that. And that's because that's what's useful for me. So it's different... Personalities will prosper better from different kinds of things. There is a dark side also to the bright side. Okay, so there was a book about this not long ago called Bright Sided Naomi Klein? Was it Naomi Klein? Anyway, somebody. And basically the argument was that the idea of positive psychology is used in a way that can be co-opted to make everything your fault because you're not positive enough. So if you're in work and your boss is abusive, well, you make a complaint to HR and then it's like, well, you know, you really need to be looking on the bright side of this. Yeah? I mean, that's an extreme example, but that's the kind of thing. And it's the idea that if you're making any criticisms, that there's something inherently unhealthy or unethical about being critical. Right? Obviously, that's not the case. Sometimes being critical is entirely necessary. And so bright siding then tends to say things like, if you're sick, it's your fault. You see, if you could only manifest a more positive attitude, then you'd be healthy. Yeah? And the Buddha got sick, by the way. So I don't know what that says about his attitude. Maybe he was being too much of a Debbie Downer, and that's why he got a backache and got dysentery and so on. Or it could be that not all sickness comes just because of your attitude towards the sickness. So this is kind of, it can be this downside to like this excessive focus on having the bright side of all things. Part of the downside can be that it can exclude or alienate certain people who are not going to relate to that. And it can also be like a displacement that can cause you to not hear and make the changes that are needed when they are needed. So like all things, moderation is good, right? So as a general rule, it's good to, you know, have a positive attitude and a healthy, optimistic, forward-looking attitude to things, but not too much, like 80-20 positive to negative, something like that, you know, like mostly positive and then, you know, from time to time, well, we need to do, you know. So obviously it's much more fun to be around positive people, right? Everyone's saying, yeah, everyone's good, and that's great. And it's really nice to be working in that kind of environment.
but also we need to not go on the too much of an extreme with these things. Now, the way that the Buddha worked was very interesting, as always, because the Buddha was almost like obsessively balanced in his presentation of positive and negative sides of things. I mean, this is the standard format for a sutta, is he'll present, you know, there are these five bad things and then there are these five good things, which are the counterbalance, yeah? And constantly doing this, yeah, presenting the downside of something and then the upside of something. So these are the, you know, the five dangers if you don't keep your precepts. And then we'll list those five dangers, and then there are five benefits if you do keep your precepts, and then list those five benefits. So he will always kind of end up on the positive side. All right? So, and this also is kind of psychologically canny, because what that means is that when you finish the sutta, you're feeling good, because they always end on a positive note, yeah? And it feels constructive, yeah? So you present the negative side first and then the positive side, right? This is the problem and then this is the solution. And that's like a really nice way of doing it, because if you're only about problems, then, well, you just end up feeling negative and hopeless. But if it's only about solutions all the time, then it can all sound a bit kind of bland and you don't really know why that it is that you're doing the things that you do. So the Buddhist attitude is always that sense of balance of positive and negative. But the positive and negative... Oh, thank you. That's right. Melanie, for the details on that book, Bright Sided, How Positive Thinking is Undermining America, Barbara Ehrenreich. I haven't actually read the book, but I've read a number of kind of reviews and so on of it, so I sort of know the general gist of it. So... from a Buddhist point of view, again, we can look at this in terms of the Four Noble Truths, okay? And the Four Noble Truths, which are... Oh, suffering, right. What was the next one? The cause of suffering. Ending of suffering. And what was the last one? The path. Okay, very good. Excellent. So the suffering, cause, ending, and the path. Okay, that makes sense. Good. Now I know that. Thank you for that. Very good. so it begins. So that follows the same pattern. You begin with suffering, right? You begin. Oh, this is what's wrong with things, right? We're actually, it's suffering because life actually, you get sick, you get old, you die. It kind of sucks, actually. And everybody knows that, you know? And it's weird because you sort of go around in the world, and like you can walk around. Like when you finish tonight, you can go out, you go into the streets of Harris Park. Everyone's like going out and enjoying a meal and having being happy and so on. But like there's always this kind of sense of unease underneath it because you all know you're going to die. So you got to keep yourself up. We got to tell you, yeah, nice, oh, things. Oh, yeah, and we're going to die. And so the Buddha said, you keep on reminding yourself of that. Keep on remembering. Yeah. And so suffering, and then the origin and the ending of suffering, and then the path. And of course, in the path, it is. Overwhelmingly about happiness. And the path is about finding happiness within yourself and developing that through meditation. So much so that when we do the Anamodana chant, the blessing chant, we go, Ayuvarno Sukhang Balang, right? You know that chant? We say, Ayuvarno Sukhang Balang. Yeah? Anybody know what those words mean? Are you? Life, right? Vanno. Color. So we're wishing that you be colored, is that right?
Oh, beauty.
Beauty. Ai vanno, sukhang balam. Sukha? Happiness. And bala, yeah? Health or strength, yeah? So the Buddha, of course, gave spiritual meaning. So this is kind of a standard kind of worldly blessing, and you can understand it in that sense because they're the things that most people want. And, you know, definitely if you want long life, so practice the Buddha's path and practice generosity, it's much more effective than the other way, which is to become like a multi-billionaire and then try to go for immortality and like having yourself be resurrected in a computer in the future or something like that. Like that's like probably not going to work. I'm just gonna make that fairly controversial statement. Probably not going to work out, whereas the Buddha's path to long life will work out. By one or beauty, right? Everybody wants to be pretty. Much cheaper than plastic surgery. Yeah, definitely. Sukhang, happiness, blah, is health, good health. So the Buddha gave spiritual meanings to all of these. So what are the spiritual meanings? I'm just trying to have to remember what they are. For Ayu, the spiritual sense meaning is, I think, the development of the four Iddhipadas. So four Iddhipadas is, what are they again? No. Yeah, and no. But you're confident about it, so that's good. Four Iddhipadas, wholesome desire. Thank you, Mel. Chanda, yes. And then energy, number two, yeah? And then Chitta, yeah? Chitta, or our purified mind. And the last one, Vimamsa, right? Investigation or inquiry. Mel, you're on a roll there, and then you just, no, mindfulness isn't in that one. I'm sorry about that. Okay. So this is these, according to Buddhism, if you practice these things, because Buddha said then that you can extend your lifespan, right? So, and there's a bit of a controversy about whether he means you can extend your lifespan so that you will live a full life, or so that you like literally will live to the end of the eon. Okay? So, I mean, this is kind of a bit of a controversial topic in Buddhism, but in traditional Buddhism, you know, there was a belief that certain people would live until a very long time, and that there are people alive today who were alive in the time of the Buddha or a little bit later. Okay, so this is a traditional belief. Other times there might be like, there's a traditional belief that Mahakasapa, the great disciple of the Buddha, is actually sitting in Samadhi, where he's in the middle of a mountain called the Kukutapadagiri in Bihar, and he's going to stay there until the next Buddha comes, and then he's going to give him his robe. I don't know whether that's the case. The more conservative reading of that passage is that it gives you the Kukutapadagiri mountain, the Kukutapadagiri. There was an essay by Shramana Dhammika who identified the Kukutapadagiri. Dan asked which mountain was Mahakasapa in, and then his next link is to flights.google.com. Look, if you find anything, Dan, then do let us know, okay? You know, take a selfie and that would be great. Okay, so, beauty. So what's that all about? What's the spiritual explanation for that? Keeping precepts, I think. I think it's keeping precepts. Lots of metta, also good, right? Lots of metta, also good. Then sukha. And sukha is the four jhanas. Yeah, sukha is the four jhanas. And bala, I think, is the five balas, five spiritual parishes. Yeah, five balas, I think. Been a while since I've looked at that one. So main point I was just getting at, that was a bit of a long way around, but the main point I was getting at was that sukha or happiness is used in the suttas as a word for meditation, specifically a word for the jhanas, right? So that while the truth of Buddhism, the reality that we have to confront is the reality of suffering, but the path or what from that, how we live and what we do is the path of happiness. Yeah. Now, the Buddha
obviously knew that the path, I mean, the path is complicated, and it's not always just all happy, and we are going to encounter stuff along the way, pain, despair, confusion, grief, all of those things. This is part of our path. So the Buddha acknowledged this, and he talked about it sometimes, that those things are just things that, like ordinary things that might happen, like we might experience loss or we might experience sickness and so on. We experience those kinds of suffering along the path. There are other kinds of suffering that arise specifically because of the path. Right, then we might be when we're meditating, and then we're like, oh, it comes back to what you mentioned before about envy. You're meditating and thinking, how come that person over there is meditating so well? And I can't even sit still for 2 minutes, and they're just like going so, and they look so peaceful. And that other person sitting over there thinking, why is that person over there meditating so well? I can't even make my mind peaceful for 2 minutes. Yeah. So we can have these kinds of things arise from a spiritual level, and the Buddha called Niramisa Domanasa is like the sense of longing and spiritual sadness, especially when you contemplate how beautiful and how wonderful Nibbana is and how crap I am and how far away everything seems and how sometimes it looks like, oh my goodness, I've been practicing for so long and doing all these things, and how am I ever going to get? And so this is this kind of spiritual depression that can arise. So these are things that we encounter along the path. So the Buddha talked about the path that is the Sukhapatipada and the Dukkhapatipada, right? The pleasant way of practice and the painful way of practice. When he was talking about monks, he said that, even if a monk lives in despair and depression every day with tears running down their face, but they still keep going and then they don't disrobe, then they're still making progress, they're still there, so that happens, it's a reality, but it's not what the Buddha's recommending. He's not encouraging us to do that. He's saying even if your path has a lot of suffering, then it's still worthwhile practicing. But the better path is the Sukhapatipada. And I always remember Ajahn Brahm said that when he first learned about this teaching, there's like the pleasant path with swift progress, the pleasant path with slow progress, the painful path with swift progress, and the painful path with slow progress. And sort of most people look at it and think, oh, yeah, I'm that one, Ajahn Brahm, of course, looked at it and said, okay, that's mine, I'm going to do that one. Swift and pleasant, that's going to be my one. So all of them are progress, right? So that's fine, as long as we keep going, it doesn't matter. But if we can have a path of happiness and joy, then that's a lot better. So don't use don't make an excuse that the dukkha is good for you. Dukkha isn't particularly good for you. That's why it's dukkha. Like it's okay, right? It's all right. You can learn something from it, but you're better off being happy. You can still experience Dhamma if you're happy. In fact, it's a lot better for most things. So it's okay. So don't feel like, don't kind of get into a mind state. It's very easy to do where you can sort of justify to yourself that the kind of pain and suffering somehow, it can just sort of turn it into a sort of a path by itself. What we should be aiming for and trying to do is to build a path of happiness and joy. That's the most important thing. Luckily, the Buddha told us how to do that. Yay! So, and remember, the Buddha only wanted us to be happy. That's it. He never wanted us to suffer. So don't despair. Don't feel like, don't feel like you're kind of lost on this path or something like that. Remember, when that happens, just remember the Buddha wanted me to be happy. That's all he ever cared about. And so just all of those factors of the Noble Eightfold Path are there so that we can be happy, and that includes all of them from right view, right thought or right intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and samadhi. Yeah, great. Thank you so much. So all of those things are there in order to relieve us of suffering and the burdens that we're carrying around, and in order to lift our minds and our hearts up and for us to find happiness. And the simple happiness that the path brings us helps to heal our heart, helps to make us whole. It helps to make us balanced and centered and happy. And so just by doing things like keeping precepts, yeah, when we keep precepts and we're not feeling guilty, we're not feeling ashamed, we're not feeling insecure, we're gradually building those things up. When we practice generosity, it makes us feel happy. It feels nice if we can help others. And so we do these things because they're good things to do. And we also do them because they help to build a heart that is whole and happy and healthy. And the more that we do these things and the further that we go down the path, then the more this helps our heart to become happy. So one of the key ingredients, like if you look at, say, people who are suffering from depression, like one of the, like depression isn't so much like feeling sad, like that's what people, a lot of people think, like depression means you feel sad, which of course you can do when you're depressed, but it has a lot to do with like a feeling of hopelessness, you know, like you can't do anything, like you're sort of down in a hole and that you can't get out and there's nothing you can do and there's no point in it. And even though you might be sort of happy transitorily, it doesn't mean anything because it's just like a surface thing. It just goes and it doesn't hide that true darkness. And so this is why that kind of depression manifests as a sense of like, well, you can't get out of bed, you know? Like if someone's really depressed, then they're like, why should I go to the toilet? And it's like really hard to do that, just to motivate yourself to do basic things. So this is why the Buddhist response to these things is always through action. It's always through doing things. The Buddhism is a kriyavada. It's a doctrine of doing. And so we begin by trying to do positive and helpful things to build a life for ourselves. Really good example of this that was very moving for me was when I was staying in Ipoh in a cave. There's a little monastery in a cave there. And I was there for like a year or so. After I was there for a long time, this guy showed up out of the blue. Right? He just caught a bus there. He was disabled. And he could walk, but with difficulty. I think he had polio or something like that. And, you know, he just came into the center and, you know, just got talking to a couple of the guys around the center and so on. And he said that he'd, you know, because he was disabled, he couldn't work. And he was on a pension and he had a flat and couldn't do anything. And he'd just be sitting in his flat feeling so depressed and so sad and so sorry for himself until one day he thought, that's enough. You know, I've just got to try to do something. And somehow he heard about our little monastery and he just came. And so he said to the guys there, what can I do? How can I help? And they said, oh, well, we need to sweep up the leaves. Great. Grabs a broom, start sweeping. And he started coming. He had to catch a bus right from the other side of town. It's like an hour or two on the bus to get there. And he would come every day, do some sweeping, do some digging, do some little work, get to know people. And he gradually turned his life around, you know. And after he's there for a while, one of the guys is like, oh, I've got a stall in the market, but I can't go there. Can you come hold the stall for me? So he started to get work, you know. That's how it goes. We have to take responsibility to try to make something of our life and make something of the situation that we're in. It doesn't mean what happens to us is unimportant, but we can't let it define us. Yeah, and at a certain point, we're all going to have to say, like, what are we going to do about this? How are we going to choose to live? And so the Buddha said that there's always something that we can do. There's always something we can do to live a better life, to be happier, to be better, and to try to rise up above whatever circumstances that we have. So so to come back to the basic theme of
of this was the looking on the bright side of things. So just to kind of sum up, looking on the bright side of things is good, but not taken to extremes, okay? Moderately looking at the bright side of things, right? And but also being aware that different people are going to respond in different ways to this, okay? And so don't, you know, when we, how do I put this? When we relate to other people, then it's natural for us to relate to them as we would like to be related to by them, right? That's how we connect with people. Yeah? You engage with them in a way that's familiar and that you know. But you also need to be sensitive to the fact that other people are not you and they're not like you. So if they need to engage in a different way, then that's something to learn. So be positive, but not extremely so. Be alert to the fact that different people have different points of view. When considering the downsides and the bright sides of things, bear in mind the method that the Buddha used, which was to present these things in a balanced way, begin with the downside and then end with the upside. It's a very simple pattern, right? But it's very powerful. And that might apply to anything like a PowerPoint that you're doing at work, you know, or an article that you're writing, or just, you know, somebody you're talking to about something. Then you can always use that pattern. And remember that while the situation that we're in, the dukkha that we experience, is painful and burning and on fire, but the path is a path of peace and a path of happiness. So the more that we practice, then the more that we can, like, you can learn to be carried by that pleasure and that happiness in the path. You know, a bit like we were doing in the meditation, when we meditated on the breath before, when you begin, the breath just feels like, you know, it just feels like air, just feels... But the longer you go with it, the more you feel that that breath is something that's very beautiful and very pleasant that's carrying you along with it. So the deeper the practice goes, then the deeper the pleasure will be. So the bright side of things is not something in Buddhism that you can sort of assume or insist on, but it's something that you can work on and you can develop and you can find. So anyway, that's just a few thoughts on looking on the bright side of life. Thank you to Monty Python for the inspiration. And... Mel asks about why is that person going forth and I can't. I'm not sure which person, but if it was the person in the story I talked about in Ipo, just so we're clear, they didn't go forth, they just came to the monastery and helped out around the monastery. I'm not sure if that's what you were referring to. Okay. Okay.
Where do you draw the line between healthy sort of positive thinking,
mm-hmm,
as compared to
okay.
So, like, for example, if someone tells me, it's like, I'm going to get enlightened in this lifetime.
Okay.
So, like, is that a positive kind of thinking, or is that just delusion?
Okay. So the question is, where do we draw the line between positive thinking and delusional thinking? And if somebody thinks, I'm going to get enlightened in this lifetime, is that positive and aspirational, or is that simply delusional? Well, the answer, of course, is... it depends, as they say in Thai. For some people, then that's a perfectly wholesome aspiration. But then for others, maybe it is delusional. Yeah, so it's not, I don't think you can really say any hard and fast rules there. But generally speaking, it's best to, if you know, to be positive about things is to be also realistic. So to set limited goals. So if somebody says, I want to get enlightened in this lifetime, I'd maybe would encourage him to rephrase it and say, I'd like to do what I can in this lifetime to be able to let go of suffering, yeah, and take that as far as I can in this lifetime and however far that is, yeah, because there's always something that we can do to let go of suffering. And the problem is that if you set that kind of goal And if it's unrealistic, then it actually can cause you to be frustrated. Yeah. So that would be my suggestion. Dhirupa mentions that she was interesting in this topic because she was just thinking about gratitude, looking for bright things while meditating just now. Yeah, so that's also something in meditation, right? So sometimes our mind can tend to fixate on the negative, and so for that reason it's good to deliberately, consciously bring up positive things, to develop gratitude and to develop mudita and all of those positive emotions, yeah. Okay, so Mu mentions living with a mental health condition, disability, positivity can be used by those around us to try to make everything better when they cannot cope with the discomfort of how it is. Yeah, very much so, Mel, and that's something which, it's difficult. I mean, it's difficult for people to be around suffering and to be around when... if people have different kinds of mental health conditions, and this can be, it can be difficult because it violates the sense of security that we have in relation with other people. Like, we think we know who other people are, how they're going to behave, how they're going to feel, and how they're going to think. And then if we're around somebody who isn't like that, then it's kind of like, oh, I don't know what I can say because I don't know how they're going to react. And so there is that kind of difficulty. And then, as you said, then sometimes then that can manifest through this kind of bland positivity that doesn't actually acknowledge the difficulties that somebody's going through. And so then that can end up just making things worse. So that's something where, you know, again, there's no real hard and fast answer, but obviously in that situation, communication is really good. And the ability to communicate, I think for people who are going through suffering, the ability to communicate that suffering, but without lingering on it and dragging people into it, you know, that's the kind of thing. It's good for people to know that you're going through it, but when people are suffering, they don't want you to suffer as well, right? That's not the point of sharing it. It's just a point so that you know what you're going through and so we can understand each other, yeah. So Venerable Prasanna asks, how do you know when you're spiritually bypassing versus setting aside the unwholesome and developing the wholesome? How do you know when you're spiritually bypassing? Well, you usually know when push comes to shove, don't you? Right? I mean, you're all kind of positive, everyone's nice, everyone's loving and everything, and then something happens and then you're like, so that's where you usually find out. But again, I don't want to go too much into spiritual bypassing, but again, the real sort of solution is simple, humble, begin from the beginning and just gradually work from there. At the beginning, says Edie, when you analyze Buddhism and find out that it is true, all materialistic things and life is suffering, you feel kind of down by this fact because you haven't found joy in Buddha's path. How should one face this phase? Yeah, good point. I mean, and that's something which is often thought about by people who are like teaching Buddhism, writing about it and so on. Like, how do we address this? Of course, if you look at how the Buddha taught, then he did not come up to people and say, everything's dukkha, you should be suffering, and so on. So he didn't like, you know, he waited until people's minds were happy and joyful, and then he would give them the bad news. Yeah? So it's all about time and place. So, you know, one of the things in our life, in our approach to Dhamma is, of course, we don't have the Buddha, right? So we've got to make our way by ourselves, you know, and often we, you know, we find a book here and there, find something on the internet here and there, find a talk here and there, and we can't really manage like where we should be and where we should be going from. The only thing that I would say to that is that, like, when you find things that are not working for you or which are affecting you in the wrong way or whatever, especially when you're beginning on the path, just leave it to one side. It's okay. It's, you know, you don't have to know everything to begin with, and you don't have to put everything in perspective. And that's the way that spiritual path happens is that, you know, you might come back to that years later and then think, oh yeah, that's what they were getting on about. I really didn't get that in the first place. So it's okay to just put things to one side and say, look, I don't really, that's not really for me. On the other hand, I would also put out a, you know, just a caution that if you're listening to somebody who makes you feel too good about yourself, because there are a lot of snake oil salesmen out there. And there are a lot of people who are telling you exactly what you want to hear, because that's, if you want to make a lot of money, that's how you do it. And so just be careful about that, right? So if somebody's too nice, just be a little bit cautious, yeah? So if some, no, it's not if they're too nice. If somebody's feeding you, if somebody's telling you what you want to hear, yeah? Somebody's telling you what you want to hear. It's okay to tell people what they want to hear, but then people need to be challenged every now and then as well. All right. Very good. I think we should wrap up about there. What do you reckon? I think it's about enough. About enough Dhamma for one night. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thanks, everybody. Just remember, we do have our book launch with Venerable Brahmali coming up on the 9th. Of December at the Sydney State Library, so please do come along for that. We are also, there will be a number of other events with Venerable Brahmali while he was visiting, so please join us for that. He'll be here with me in Lokanta Vihara for about a week or something, so for anybody who wants to bring Bindabhata in those times, then from the 9th to the 15th, he'll be here. So I'm not sure if we'll be here for Pindabhata every day, but over that period, we will be at least most days. Santi is having a Katina on Sunday. So if you get the chance, go down to Santi. If you haven't been, then go. And if you have been, go again. Yeah. That's a lovely chance to meet the community, spend some time in nature, and to meet other Dhamma practitioners as well. Yeah, so that's the Santi Katina this Sunday. I was just down there at Santi just the other day, and very lovely, amazing to see a really flourishing community and to see the life and joy that's happening there. So it's really nice for me to see. Okay, that's about it, I think. Okay, everyone, see you next week. All right, we're also at Crow's Nest on Wednesday. Crow's Nest Center, 7 p.m., so you can come there as well.